This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Harry Hamlin. He's the author of a new book called Full Frontal Nudity. Well, it's actually not new anymore, but it's his book called Full Frontal Nudity, The Making of an Accidental Actor. Harry, it's good to talk to you.
Hi there, Dick.
So this book came out, I think, in 2010. Am I right about that?
It came out in October 2010. It was originally scheduled to come out on January 11, but they crashed it for the fall.
Just curious, was there something going on in the fall that they wanted to get it out for?
Well, they wanted to take advantage of some press opportunities that my wife and I had in the fall, and they felt that the book could stand up against the fall releases, so they crashed it. I guess that means that they accelerated the publishing time by half. In other words, it came out 6 months before it should have.
Right. So there's a great picture of you on the back, and I think that's sort of the genesis, or at least the beginning of the story, which I should say to people who are listening, this is a memoir, really the story of your life from early in your youth to when you were about 25, right about the time you were beginning to be a professional actor. So you got this great mugshot on the back of the book, which is a police lineup with your current face, not who you were in earlier years. But maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, the way the book begins is you're detained at the border coming back from Canada into the United States, which is where you're from, because of a police record that suddenly appears going back.
Well, yeah, actually I was on my way to Canada.
I
live in Canada in the summers. I have a home there, and I go up there every summer, and that's on the lake, and have a great time with my kids and all that, but also, Vancouver and Toronto have become kind of Hollywood North. So a lot of the work that I do as an actor takes place in Canada. So I was in Canada at the time at my summer place, and I got a call to work. And I don't like to work in August. I usually turn everything down in August, but this was really a delicious part and a great director. So I got on a plane, and I flew out to Vancouver. And when I got off the plane, the driver was a Sunday, but she said, you know what, we forgot that you didn't fly in from the U.S. and you have to get your work permit, and usually you get it at the airport. It's a perfunctory thing. You walk up to a guy, give him $150, you do your work permit, and off you go to your hotel. Well, it was different this time because I had flown from a point in Canada to another point in Canada and was not crossing an international border at the airport, so we had to drive by car down to Washington State, turn around, and drive back across the border so I could get my work permit. All well and good. Still a perfunctory thing, right? You go in, you give them hundreds of bucks for the work permits in the computer. But I get there, and the place was empty. There's nobody in line or anything. There's this really pretty girl behind the desk in a black uniform, and I walked up to her and said, hi, I'm Harry Hamlin, and I'm coming to work on Harper's Island, which is the name of the piece that I was going to do. I need to get my work permit. And she said, Josh, you know, I've never heard of Harper's Island. Where is it? And I said, well, it doesn't really exist. It's kind of in a store. She said, what, you're going to work in a place that doesn't exist? And I said, well, no, not exactly. I'm going to work on Harper's Island, which is a show. She said, well, where is Harper's Island? And I said, well, you know, I don't know where Harper's Island is. I don't think there is a Harper's Island. She said, well, how can you be going to work at a place that doesn't exist? And I kept trying to get it across to her that I was an actor working on a show, but she just couldn't quite get it, you know. And she said, all right, I need your work permit, I need your papers, and I need your contract. And I said, well, my papers? What do you mean? She said, well, I need your education documents. And I said, my education documents? What do you mean? She said, your diplomas. I said, you know, come on, I'm an actor. I graduated from Yale 35 years ago. I don't have a diploma. It's dust, you know. And she said, well, if you don't have it, I can't let you cross the border. Anyway, this went on and on and on. And finally, she just had such a thing up her butt for me that she went back and did a 40-year background check and came up with an arrest record for me from 1970, felony possession of narcotics. It was just an arrest. I was not ultimately convicted of felony possession of narcotics, but that bit wasn't in the computer. Only the arrest was in the computer. So she said that she had to assume that I was a felon, and felons were not allowed to go into Canada. So I was sitting there, you know, my family, everybody's in Canada. I'm not allowed to cross the border. And I thought, you know, I'm going to have to write about this. I got to write a book that chronicles my evolution from an innocent 3-year-old in Pasadena, California, to, you know, this hardcore felon sitting in this customs office in Canada. And that was the genesis of the book. A kind of long-winded genesis, but nevertheless, that's how it started.
Well, no, but it answers the question. I think that the first question you ask somebody when they write a memoir is, what prompted you to tell your story? I mean, the story itself is, you know, full of, I mean, it's great stuff. There's a, you know, and I think it's partially true. I, you know, inevitably you feel like, because I'm roughly your age, that, you know, we went through a similar period of time, and there's some shared experience for people who went through that period, I think, and had kind of similar experiences. You know, some of the 50s and 60s were, you know, I know they're, let's say, romanticized often in popular culture, and then there's a reaction against that romanticization, I think, by a lot of people. But in this book, I felt you really, you got a lot of the kind of peripatetic elements of the story. You know, there's a lot of wonderful accidental things that happen, you know, where you clearly, if you had known what was going to happen, you wouldn't have done what you did.
Isn't that true of every day?
Yeah, but not every day results in things like, you know, sort of pick out some of the terrible things that happened, or the, you know, maybe some of the great things that happened. You would not, you know, they're kind of exaggerated in hindsight maybe, but, you know, on a daily basis. I guess that was actually one of the things that this book made me think about. You know, I've thought a lot about when you're young, and maybe it was in that period more so than others, but lots of things happen that are unpredicted and accidental, and you do things without thinking about the consequences more when you're young. As you get older, obviously you become more aware of the downsides of some of your choices. So I think that sometimes the good and the bad accidents that happen when you're young can't happen as easily when you're older, unless you are forever young in your outlook, which some people are.
Well, I'll tell you this, I'd never let someone convince me to carry a bag full of pills that I didn't know what they were on a plane.
Right. Yeah, that was one of the great ones, I think, obviously, that was what caused you to get that felony conviction is, you know, I think you had stuffed a bunch of prescription pills in a guitar.
I was asked by one of the guys who lived in the house that I lived in, which was a kind of quasi-fraternity house, more commune than fraternity house at that point. But he had come to me and he said, "Are you going to L.A. for Thanksgiving?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Hey, man, here, I got this baggie with like 100 of these pills in it, and there's a guy at USC who wants to buy them, and would you consider going down and, you know, taking these to him?" And I said, "Well, sure, why not? I mean, just flying on TSA. Flying from San Francisco to L.A., it always checks your bags. There's no, in those days, there were no dogs sniffing around or anything like that. And I had, you know, a bag of pills. Maybe there weren't 100, maybe there were 50. It was a small little baggie full of some capsules or something. You know, I don't know. He never told me what it was. But I figured it was probably some, you know, some drug of some kind. And then, so he, you know, I didn't smoke pot much at all then, but he said, "Hey, you know, for your kind services here, take this," and he tossed like a bag of maybe a quarter or an eighth of an ounce of pot on my bed. And I said, "Well, I'll take it to L.A. and maybe, who knows, maybe I'll have a joint or something. I don't know." I didn't really smoke pot, but I had it. I took it and I put the bag of pills and the little baggie of pot into my sock, one of my socks. and I taped it to the inside of my guitar after I took the strings off, and I put the strings back on. This is like very, like, I must have been really paranoid, right? Because why do something like that? If I had it in my pocket, I would have been fine. But anyway, so I did that. I went to L.A., took the pill to this guy's house, you know, and turned out to be some kind of a gangster, I don't know. Anyway, he grabbed the pill, took him inside, and he came back a few minutes later and said, "Hey, Johnson, you didn't want him." So I put him back in my guitar case, and I went back to San Francisco, did the same thing again, didn't smoke any of the pot, put everything back in the sock, went back up, and when I got to the airport, my guitar didn't come out of the special handling. And they told me that it had gone to Seattle by mistake, and I had to come back and pick it up the next day. So I went back, and, well, you got to read the book. It gets pretty tense after that.
Well, yeah, it's,
but it's stupid to take a bag of pills. I didn't know what they were. You know, then the guy got pissed off with me, and when the pills were confiscated by the police, he got angry with me and wanted $100. You know, so he was a jerk.
Well, and that turned out to be a pretty major deal for you in terms of, you know, not only what happened to you, you know, and people can read it for themselves, but it's a pretty grueling experience, and the courtroom scene is unbelievable, you know, when things come to a head. So it just seems like, you know, these are crazy things that happen to kids. Hopefully, not too many things worse than that happen to, you know, to the average person, but it just seems like there was a theme of the book was a lot of these accidental, you know, things that happened to you. I mean, in a sense, that's what you described the book as. It's, you know, you became an actor almost by accident. But, you know, that was a great story,
well,
too.
It was pretty much purely by accident because of that Hell's Angel in La Honda. If he hadn't come down on his hog that night, I would not be an actor. I would probably be an architect.
Right. So what you described happening is, right, you were in this place, La Honda. You ended up taking acid with a bunch of other people, so you're late getting back to Berkeley for the registration for classes. You get back there, and all the classes for architecture are filled.
Yeah, I was late to register. I couldn't register for the architecture school because all the classes had been filled up. So I had a very short period of time, like an hour, to register, or I was going to have to wait until the next quarter in, I guess, January or something when we started. And I raced around trying to find a place where I could register for classes, and the drama department was close by. I ran in there, and I asked them if I took four drama classes, because I didn't have enough time to go to any other building. Was there a way for me to satisfy all of my freshman requirements in the drama department? And the guy thought about it for a while, and he said, well, if you do this, 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 and this, you'll satisfy your English requirement, you'll satisfy your, you know, history requirement, whatever they were. And so I immediately filled out four forms for the drama department, ran over to the administration building, and got in just in the nick of time. And I figured I'd do that for a quarter, and then, you know, then I'd go and register in the environmental design department. The only thing was that as a requirement for Acting 101, which I had to take, I had to audition for the play. And I'd never auditioned for the play before, but you know, I figured, well, I'll just show up and, you know, I won't get a part, and I'll be fine, right? Well, I showed up, and I got the part in the first play. It was not a big part, but I got the part in Salome and Salome, in Oscar Wilde's Salome. And I guess I was really good at it, because they kept hiring me after that, like one play after another, and I never had time to go to the environmental design department.
So when you were a kid, did you ever think of yourself as being an actor? Was this just a kind of, because when you say you're good at it, obviously you are good at it. It's your career, it's your life now. But it's just, I mean, that's a pretty amazing discovery to make. You know, did you even?
Well, when I was in high school, my senior year in high school, I was in the choir, and I couldn't sing at all. But the guy who was the head of the choir was, he liked me, put it that way. And so he used to put me out in the front and tell me to lip sync, because I couldn't sing, right? But he wanted me there anyway. So he came to me in this, my senior year in the spring, and he said, look, we're doing this play called The Fantastics, and it's all cast and everything, but the kid who was playing the smallest part in the piece, the character is called The Man Who Dies, I think, no lines. He just dies on stage really well. But the kid who was playing him got mono. So they came and asked me to replace him, and which I did, and I was terrified the whole time I was on stage. I never had to say a word or sing a note. I just had to die on stage. But I was better in abject terror the whole time. So I never really fostered the notion that that would be where I would end up making my career. You know, but all is well that ends well. So I'm not unhappy about that.
No, and in fact, the same sort of thing happened when you were in Berkeley looking for a place to live. That was another great kind of classic 60s story, you know, of accidental congruency. It's almost, you know, crazy, but you walked into a building which had a for rent sign on it, and it turned out that they knew who you were.
Now that's really weird. I mean, I just ran into Mike Stimson, who's in the book, and ran into him a couple months ago. The Deke House, ironically, threw a party for me. Even though I'm surprised that the people who were involved with the Deke organization now would have anything to do with me after reading his book. But I did run into him, and we reminisced about that day, which he remembered when I came to the house. And I said, I'm looking for a room to rent. I'm Harry Hamlin. I'm a freshman. He said, oh, your room's right over here. I said, what? You know, and that was too strange. And it turned out that my brother, who had been a Deke at Stanford, had written a letter on my behalf to the Deke House in Berkeley without my knowing it, saying that I would probably come and pledge, whatever that is.
Right, but I mean, the most bizarre part of it is you didn't know you were at the Deke building when you walked in there.
No, because the for rent sign was covering the three Greek letters on the
right.
Front.
I didn't
want anybody to know it was a fraternity house at the time. All
right.
They wanted to do was rent rooms.
So, fraternities at that time in Berkeley, this is, you know, the late 60s, obviously, I assume that the fraternity scene was kind of transformed by the counterculture into something else, which clearly you were part of.
Well, in the case of the Deke House, it was utterly transformed. There were, I think, I did see some guys at other fraternity houses with kegs of beer during the time that I was there, but very few. Most of the fraternity houses were either shuttered, closed down, or empty, or they were populated by very few people. There were some jock fraternities. You know, the Deke House had become a full-on commune with vegetarian food and, you know, lots of marijuana smoke and boys and girls living in the house. So,
right, which was illegal. I mean, technically illegal because the fraternity, the national fraternity, was still all boys?
Well, of course, the fraternities are all boys. But it technically, I mean, illegal in, not in terms of any state or federal law.
No, but illegal by the rules.
In terms of the bylaws of the fraternity.
Right.
And it would have been illegal by state law if that house had been owned by the university, and many of the houses are. Fraternity houses are owned by the university. If that had been the case, I would have been really, you know, up the creek without a paddle. But it so happened that that house is privately owned. So when as I was president in this, my sophomore year, which is odd in and of itself, but it was only because I was the most sober person living there. And so I was the person who was able to change light bulbs and keep the toilet paper in the bathrooms and collect the rent. My second year, everything was fine, and we had, as I say in the book, we had the highest grade point average of any fraternity on campus because we had 10 girls living there, and they were very studious, you know, and the boys, of course, we were all, you know, I had a high grade point average, but most of the guys didn't. But anyway, the girls made up for it, and everything was hunky-dory until we had a fire one night. I was out of town, but they had a fire at the fraternity, and the fire department came at 3 o'clock in the morning and was plucking girls off the roof with cherry pickers in their nightgowns, you know. So in the Berkeley Daily Gazette got a hold of it, and it was my first actual national press I got clippings sent to me from the South, from relatives in the South, because I was called a pimp, and it was said by the university that I was running a brothel at the Beach House. So anyway, that was kind of an interesting turn of events. So Reagan was governor. He found out about it. I was called into the dean's office and asked to leave. They said they couldn't kick me out because there were no grounds to kick me out, but that the governor, the Board of Regents, and the university would, in the strongest possible terms, like me to move along. And I said, what does that mean exactly? And they said, well, that means move along. You won't be here next year. Transfer out, go to another school. And I said, okay, well, ironically, I made an application to another school, and on a whim, kind of, and I haven't heard back yet from him, but I'd love to go there. And he said, what school? And I said, well, it's Yale. And he said, okay, we'll see what we can do about that. And so I ended up going to Yale.
So do you think Berkeley did something to help you get into Yale?
You know, I can never be certain of that, but I did have, I was on the dean's list, ironically, and the dean was telling me to kick out of town, but, you know, I had a high, I was at 4 point, or close to a 4 point, and, I guess you can be a 5 point now, but in those days, the highest you could do is a 4 point, and, I think maybe they did, I think they might have made a call and said, you know, get this kid out of here. I don't know. I have no idea. I just know that I got in. And whether or not they helped or not, probably will go to the grave with the team.
Right. Well, you'll never know because anybody who was involved was probably not around anymore anyway.
Well, you never know. Yeah.
But so that's another kind of story of, you know, as you call it, a whim. You know, I think you applied to Yale because basically you wanted to be close to your girlfriend who was going to Bennington.
She had applied to Bennington and sort of forgotten about it. Her mother had died in the fall that year, before that she had made this application to Bennington and never told me about it. And we were living together now for several months in the house. And then one day she got this letter of acceptance from Bennington, and she was all excited. And I said, what do you mean? You're going to Bennington? I didn't know about that. And she said, well, you know, I promised my mom I would go, and she's dead, and I got to go. And so I said, well, that means you're not coming back to Berkeley next year? And she said, no, I'm going to go to Bennington. So I made this application to Yale at the last minute. I mean, probably about 2 weeks before applications had to be sent in, maybe less. And I got this application from the library, and I filled it out, sent it off, special delivery, and then they ended up getting into Yale, but she ended up chickening out.
Right.
And not going to Bennington, which is kind of a bummer. But that's the way it was.
Right. But again, that sort of fits the pattern, I think, for you in this whole story of, you know, it being... It's almost like a bait and switch. you did all these things without really thinking about the consequences, I would say, which is probably normal at this point. But
well, I think, you know, I tried to get a copy of my application to Yale, which now has been destroyed, I found out. But I filled it out on a whim, you know, kind of never thinking that I would get in. And I remember the essay that I wrote was totally tongue-in-cheek. And it was, it's astonishing that I got in based on, you know, this completely tongue-in-cheek essay that I wrote about my experience at Berkeley. Probably I did have some help from the university.
Well, but it was also that, you know, that was a particular period of, at Yale where the admissions policies had been completely revamped, under Kingman Brewster, and the admissions director was this guy Inslee Clark, and they were
right. I remember him.
Yeah, they really wanted a different mixture of people than the, you know, the traditional Yale that had been all men, and fed by, you know, a series of boarding schools and, you know, kind of heavily East Coast and heavily children of Yale families. So, you know, they were taking a different kind of person, and they were interested in seeding, you know, the student body with people who were different and had, you know, a different kind of level of creativity. It was, you know, it was actually a pretty interesting period.
Well, I guess I lucked out there, huh?
Or maybe if you want to look at it the other way, that, you know, you benefited from this, you know, this great opportunity. But so, and, you know, the other thing that happened, I noticed you did a huge amount of driving across country. You know, obviously being from California, but, you know, you had so many trips across country, and I think you were driving a BMW, you know, an early Beamer. 2002,
yeah.
Yeah, which might.
I've done 24 cross-country trips thus far.
Right, that's pretty amazing in itself. I have this sort of vague memory of, because I was, you know, I was always interested in cars, and especially unusual cars, and I was in New Haven the same time you were. I am almost positive I remember your car. I don't think I knew you, but I certainly remember the car. Because there weren't too many BMW 2002s, you know, on the streets of New Haven in 1971.
Yeah, well, there were two that I knew of, my roommates and mine. The odd thing was that the other guy who owned a BMW at Yale happened to be my roommate.
Right.
Which is really weird.
Another amazing coincidence.
Yeah.
So,
he knew what was good, you know.
So, do you still drive cross-country? Have you done it recently?
The last time I did it, I took my son. My son went to Princeton, and he got into Yale, but he kind of thumbed his nose at me and decided to go to Princeton instead. So I drove him across, like, 6 or 7 years ago. The last time I did it.
Was it as much fun or less fun than it was back then?
Well, I mean, we were on a mission, for one thing, to get this car and him to school. When I've done it other times, when I've taken back roads and taken much more time and taken more interesting routes, I think we took like Route 80 or something across the last time. But I mean, it's all I always like to do. I mean, driving on the interstate isn't that much fun, but if you can do back roads, it's a blast. And I still have a lot to see. I haven't been to Mount Rushmore. I haven't been to the Grand Canyon yet. Almost burned down Yellowstone, though.
Well, yeah, that's another great story in the book. I love that was another amazing. I just think, you know, you look at that and think, could this really be true? You know, could you have almost set the whole place on fire? So you maybe want to tell that story.
Yeah, it was this young girl that we picked up hitchhiking, and she was really sweet, you know, and she looked like she was a hippie, but it turns out she just looked like a hippie. She was much more of a housewife and type, and we camped out in West Thumb or something, Yellowstone, and it was August, but there was nobody there. Maybe Yellowstone in those days maybe wasn't the same as it is now. Now I hear it's really crowded when you go there in the summer, but we were driving across country to go to Woodstock, and a friend of mine and I, and we picked this girl up, and we were staying in colored campgrounds and stuff all the way across, and we were cooking using a Coleman stove, cooking like beans and stuff every night, and this girl got up in the morning. She slept in the car in the tent one night with us. Anyway, she woke up early in the morning and decided she'd do us a favor and wash all the dishes from the night before that we'd locked in the car so the bears wouldn't get them. I had the tailgate of the station wagon down and was washing the dishes, and she was pouring into this bucket on the stove that had all the dirty dishes on it. She was pouring what she thought was water from a jerry can, and it was actually white gas.
Right, which is what people use to run the Coleman stove.
It was for the stove.
Right.
We had a big can of it, you know, because we needed a lot to go get across the country. And she just poured this in there, and I saw it going in, and I was going to say, no, and all of a sudden this whole thing just exploded. I mean, and she was knocked back off her feet, and the low-hanging branches caught fire, and it was fire everywhere because the gasoline was everywhere. It burned out quite quickly everywhere else, but then the trees were like starting to catch on fire. And I looked up and I thought, oh my God, you know, this is out of control. I can't put this out, you know, and we were all freaking out, and all of a sudden it started to rain. And it rained like a downpour for a few minutes, and then it cleared up.
Yeah, I know. It's like God. It's sort of like God was.
If it hadn't rained,
right.
You know, like that, we would be screwed.
Right. You see.
So
that's almost like, you know, a biblical story, where you know, where the heavens open up for a purpose. That's a great story, I think.
Well, you know, I mentioned in the book that I became a Jesus freak when I was in my late teens, and had a really profound spiritual experience during that. But it was not the experience that I'd expected to have, nor the experience that any of the people who were expecting me to have that experience were wanting me to have. But I did have a very profound experience, and I've never been a religious person since then, but I've been a very spiritual person since then, because a lot of the things that happened that I describe in the book like that are these extraordinary coincidences or happenstances that you go, wait a minute, that just doesn't make sense. That doesn't happen, you know. But then there's a whole chapter in the book where I say, but that's the way it is. Later in the book, when I describe the chance meeting of the boy, of the girl who was the lover of my girlfriend's brother who killed himself because she had left him. I don't know if you remember that part of the story.
Yeah, I do.
But that's like crazy that I would end up meeting and knowing that woman.
Right.
After, you know, all the way across the country, and making no sense to the audience right now because I've skipped around a little bit too much. But.
No, but I think it's the general theme. I think that's what I was trying to get at, is that you know, there is that feeling of almost an unseen, you know, you don't want to say an unseen hand, but you do sort of get that feeling of that you communicate about what happened to you then. There's one question I have to ask you, which is really not a profound thing at all. You mentioned something called a trick about tying a cigarette up and still being able to and throw it against the wall and still be able to smoke it.
Right.
Maybe you could describe how you do that, because you really didn't talk about how that works.
Well, that's going to cost you.
Well, whatever it is, I'll pay.
Well, I've never described before how you do it. I can show somebody how to do it. I can try to describe how it's done.
Well, maybe it's impossible.
But it's a trick that I learned in jail, and you take a cigarette, and then you remove the cellophane from the outside of the cigarette pack, and you flatten the cellophane out, and then you roll the cigarette up into the cellophane and twist both ends very tightly.
Right.
Then gradually bend the cigarette until you can tie it into a knot, and then you tighten it as tight as you can, and then you stomp on it as hard as you can with your heel of your boot, and you throw it against the wall, then you unwrap it, and it doesn't have a tear in it.
There you go. So the trick, I couldn't figure it out, and now I understand. So you did, in fact, do a good job of communicating verbally something that I think is very difficult to visualize.
Uh-huh.
So I commend you for that.
Well, I don't smoke anymore, but and cigarettes are so expensive now that probably nobody wants to try it, but it does work, and you can give it a try, and